Blog Talk Radio.
Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Monday, March the 11th. Today, we're going to talk with our friend Richard Baer, chief political correspondent over at the American Thinker. And we're going to talk about the Democrats. The Democrats have really been the story of 2019. I wasn't sure what to make of this new Democrat majority. I figured they would have some disputes. I had no idea, though, that it would be as incredible as it has been. They have been the story, all these divisions. And one of those divisions is over Israel, which had been for a long time a sure thing with the Democrats. I'm not sure if that's the case anymore. So we'll see what Richard has to say about that. Let me begin by saying hello to Richard. How are you, Richard?
Doing fine, Silvio. Thanks for having me back on.
Well, it's always a pleasure to have you on. How's the weather in the Windy City?
It looks like spring's arrived. We may be over 40 degrees for the next week.
Well, that's great. You know, the Cubs are opening here. At the end of March, they're opening here with the Rangers, so that should be fun starting the baseball season the last week of March. I think they're doing it so that they can get the season over before November, I guess, before November.
It seems they've caught on that having the White Sox open the last few days in March is not a good barometer of getting fans into the ballpark. So.
That's right. Well, if you notice, I took a look at the schedule, and they're favoring the southern teams and the fairweather teams, you know, in the first week. I don't think the Tigers are opening, and I don't think the Twins are opening.
Yeah.
Well, Milwaukee, of course, has a roof, so that's the good fortune there. But anyway, always great to have you, and I wanted to talk about the Democrats. Well, let's begin with the big story of this afternoon, and that is that Mrs. Pelosi, Speaker Pelosi, has made a public statement that this is, you know, impeachment is not a good idea. She doesn't think it's a good thing at this moment. I think it's political reality. How do you see it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think she may be trying to reassert her leadership after it was undermined last week by the three sort of freshman monsters in the Democratic caucus, Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, and Rashida Tlaib, who have been giving her and other Democrats fits. The Democrats won control of the House because they threw out a bunch of Republicans in swing districts, suburban districts, all over the country, which can go back to the Republicans just as easily in next year as they were lost in this past November. And I don't think Pelosi wants to just a two-year tenure as Speaker. So she's getting a little nervous that her members are sort of out of control. And that's sort of what happens when you get in the majority. When you expand your ranks, you become a fractious coalition. Parties are always coalitions, and the Democrats now go really from pretty far left to people who would be considered mainstream and conceivably, you know, even potential Republicans. Joe Manchin is, you know, probably has his tendencies to vote Republican more often than the Republican senators from Maine and Alaska. So I think Pelosi was this mark of realism, and I think it's because that there was a very negative reaction to Jerry Nadler sending out document requests for 81 people, which looked like a massive fishing expedition. And And there's already fear, I think, on the left, you know, and then MSNBC and CNN, that if Mueller comes up with nothing on collusion, that the public's going to lose interest. You know, they're going to say, what the hell is the House doing, spending all its time investigating? I thought we were electing people who were going to have a different agenda.
Yeah. One of the when I heard Mrs. Pelosi today, or Speaker Pelosi, say that, I said political reality, but also maybe she remembers The last impeachment, which was, of course, President Clinton, and that impeachment took about 90 days, if you remember.
Yeah.
And for 90 days, nothing got done.
Right.
So if, for example, if you were to project impeachment in this Congress, let's say that they were to come up with articles of impeachment, let's say April, and they put them up to a debate, and then they put them up to a vote, and then assuming it all works out, I mean, you could be looking at maybe 3 or 4 months in 2019 where nothing gets done.
Sure.
This is a Congress that has to go back to many of those moderate districts saying, we didn't do anything. We just spent all our time impeaching Trump. So that's also the other reality here too, Richard.
Yeah, and I think, you know, again, some of the comments, like Nadler's comment that we already know that Trump obstructed justice. Really? He knows that without having conducted any hearings? Based on what information? Because if obstruction of justice is one of the things that the Mueller team was investigating, not just Russian collusion, but also obstruction in how the Trump White House reacted to the investigation. So if they don't come up with anything on that, they're just undercutting this entire House effort. So there's a lot of pressure. I mean, you have Tom Steyer, the climate hysteric, who's been funding tens of millions of dollars in campaigns to get people to push the impeachment agenda. I mean, he wisely decided not to run for president. He would have been polling, I think, somewhat behind Kirsten Gillibrand, probably about 0.5% if he ran.
Mm-hmm.
So this is his next best thing to stay relevant. But I think there are saner heads, and people understand that impeachment, even if you get votes in the House, you're not going to get 67 Republicans. I mean,
mm-hmm.
what new information is going to come out that's not already out that would cause 15 Republicans to vote to impeach their president? It's not going to happen.
Right. Well, and it would be strictly a partisan vote
mm-hmm.
in the House.
Right.
I don't even think you'll get 5 Republicans to vote to impeach.
Yeah, and that's exactly right.
Is
that with Nixon, it was, in fact, a bipartisan effort. It was Republicans
mm-hmm.
who went to the White House and told him he's going to resign because the bottom was falling out of his support in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
Clinton
right.
was strictly party line, and not all the Democrats voted against impeachment. A few of them voted for it, but no, you know, Republicans, by and large, voted for impeachment, but not all of them either. So to get impeachment, you got to have a broad bipartisan and pervasive. I mean, it's got to be so obvious because the country, they got an election coming up in 2020.
Right.
I mean, candidates have been running for the last few months already. Why would you need to impeach a president when you can just vote him out of office, which is the appropriate way to deal with it?
Right, exactly. And then the other thing, too, that seems to get lost in this debate, or at least, you know, when I talk to Democrats, they always, or, you know, here locally, they'll say, well, impeach him because he broke the law. And then when you ask him which one he broke,
mm-hmm.
they can't tell you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, what exactly did he do wrong? Well, like you say, obstruction of justice. Okay. Where did he do that? Well, he fired Comey. He can fire anybody who works for him. So, you know, they go out and they say these things, and it works real well in a room of people who agree with him. But when you get him out of that room and you put him in the real world, impeaching President Trump could backfire because, look, if there was law breaking, I'd be the first one to say, let me look at it.
Sure.
But
sure.
this is I haven't seen anything that President Trump has done.
Yeah, I mean, the supposedly what the Southern District of New York's looking at is campaign finance violations. You know anybody's going to get impeached for campaign finance violations? He paid off women he may have slept with. I mean, you don't have to be running for office to do that, to make it a campaign finance violation. That's something with people with money have been paying off people for years. I mean, look at Hollywood, which is all Democrats. They've been buying off their women and their lawyers for the last 30, 40, 50 years. So, I mean,
but also, I was going to say, Richard, that could also be a case of be careful what you wish for, because you may get it. Because if, in fact, you start opening this door of paying off women, a lot of Democrats may very well to admit that they did it. And then you'll have, you know, remember when they went after Kavanaugh on the yearbook? Well, that became a bigger issue for them because now you've got a couple in Virginia who had yearbook problems.
Right.
So I think if I was a smart Democrat, I would focus, if I was a Democrat, I should say, I would focus on defeating President Trump in 2020
right.
and trying to come up with an alternative program. The
right.
problem is I haven't seen anybody that sounds that much different. They all seem to be the same way. I thought maybe a couple of these governors might bring some sanity to the ball game, but so far I haven't really seen anything other than climate change and climate change and Medicare for all. That's all I seem to be hearing, Richard.
Yeah, I mean, what you have is the purest candidate out there, who is Sanders, and who says he was the authentic voice 4 years ago, and he's building a theme of they stole it from me with superdelegates. The election was rigged, or I would have been nominated, and I would have beaten Donald Trump, and Hillary was a terrible candidate, and the party supported her, and now it's my turn, and notice that everybody else now is adopting my ideas. And that's the problem, is nobody wants to look quite as crazy as Bernie or quite as far out there, but they can't stray too far from essentially where the energy is in the party, which is, you know, millennials and Generation Z, half or more of them think capitalism is a failed system, and they seem to think Venezuela and Cuba is a model for American growth.
Well, they wouldn't be thinking that tonight because the lights don't work in Caracas, so they couldn't use their Skype or their WhatsApp tonight to communicate with each other. But before we get to Israel, let me give you a scenario. We get to the convention. Nobody wins the first ballot. It's a fight between Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders and whatever. And in the second round, the superdelegates come in and they give it to Joe Biden. Would that be fun to watch, you think, on television, Richard?
It would be fun for you and me.
Yes, we would be having the time of our life, and I can just see all of this happening and Trump tweeting every 5 minutes about what's going on, you know? That would be fun.
People in my neighborhood would be pulling their hair out, but, you know, that's okay.
Yeah, no, I can tell you that's Karl Rove the other day was explaining their process, and it's maddening. I mean, it's all based on what is it, proportional?
Proportional, yeah.
And then
So they basically get to a nominee more quickly. The Democrats,
right, yeah.
It looks like it's designed to get to the convention this time. When you have this many candidates, if there are four or five of them who stay in and are funded well enough to stay in there, and that could happen because if Sanders is in the lead and there are people in the party who think that he's going to go down, he's the one Democrat who could lose to Trump because he's too crazy and too radical and too angry and too old. And people who are angry do not win general elections. The person who has a more positive image for the country tends to win. And I don't know if you ever saw this article, but in 1960, when Nixon debated Kennedy and they had those first televised debates, people who listened on the radio all thought Nixon won decisively. People who were watching on television all thought Kennedy won decisively. Why?
Right.
Because he looked at the camera, he was smiling,
right.
He was better looking. Nixon was sweating, he kept looking at Kennedy, you know, which is what debaters do, forgetting that he's on television and there are 60 million people
right.
watching him. And this is the
yes.
same thing this year. If the Democrats are afraid that Sanders is going to be the nominee, they may fund whoever's in second place and third place and fourth place to keep him in the race, hoping for exactly the scenario you laid out of somebody
right.
being anointed on the second ballot who they think has a better chance of winning. I'm not sure it's Biden.
Yeah,
I
agree with you. Biden could very, I mean, could deflate the minute he announces. I mean, he
right.
could lose all the air. But the one thing that I just getting back to impeachment, and then we'll get to Israel.
Sure.
The one thing about impeachment that I find that Nancy Pelosi may have been a bit of wishful thinking is that I can see a guy like this gentleman, Steyer, is that his name? The fellow
Tom Steyer.
I can see Tom Steyer saying to one of the candidates, look, I will personally finance you in the primaries and just give you all the money you need if you continue to talk about impeachment. So I can just see him picking a candidate, and that candidate will stay until the convention, literally because he's got the money, and he says, no, Trump has to be impeached. So that's why, as much as Nancy Pelosi makes a logical case against impeachment, you're not dealing here with logical people.
Oh, no, exactly. And the other thing is, think of what happens. Let's assume Trump were impeached. Well, for one thing, it will probably negatively affect the political scores and ratings and approval numbers for Democrats running for Congress, the Senate, and the presidency. But the second is, what if they were successful? They get it to a Senate vote, and the Senate got disgusted with Trump. Something comes out, and they decided to impeach him. You got Mike Pence.
That's it.
I mean,
right.
I don't,
and then Mike Pence. Right, Mike Pence then nominates or selects somebody like Marco Rubio for VP,
yep.
And he goes into the campaign quite strong. Well, let's talk about Israel. I saw the article that you wrote this week, and I'm maybe paraphrasing what you said, so please correct me if I'm wrong, but I think what you said is that it's becoming very, very difficult for any Jewish American to support the Democrat Party over Israel. I think that's kind of how you said it.
If Israel is an issue that matters. In other words, if you're a Jewish Democrat and your top three agenda items are abortion, abortion, and abortion, or abortion, climate change, and income inequality, then you'll stick with the Democrats because Israel is not high on your agenda. But if Israel is part of your agenda, if you think it's important that the state survive, that it continue to play the role it has, then you don't have a home anymore because the left is taking over the party, and one of the core themes of the left is hostility to Israel, that America has got to stop giving foreign aid, it's got to stop supporting them at the United Nations, it has to become friendlier to the Palestinians, as if somehow it's the Palestinians haven't had any role in the reason they are in the position they're in now.
Right.
You turn down every chance you're ever offered for a state. Don't blame Israel for the fact you don't have one. But this is an article of faith, and I mean, I've seen it, in political events here in Chicago and in Illinois. When you get the hardcore left together, they were just during the Iraq War, for instance, the opposition to the Iraq War. They were talked about two occupations: the Iraqi occupation and the Israeli occupation. I mean, the two of them were always linked, and it's a matter of faith that these people are going to go want this issue to be raised. They're loving it that these new members of Congress are sort of making the issue visible and making the established Democrats uncomfortable because they want to get this agenda debated. They want it on MSNBC. They want Chris Hayes and Rachel Maddow talking about Israel in a negative fashion. And they want to change American policy.
But I'm just out of curiosity, what percentage of the Jewish American population, I mean, how would you break it down? For what percentage is it important? For what percentage
Good question.
It's not? I'm just curious as how you see it.
Yeah. Well, first of all, about between two-thirds and 75% of Jewish Americans tend to vote Democratic. Obama got towards the high end of that range. The first time he ran, it dropped off a little bit the second time because there were some people who thought he wasn't very friendly. But generally, Republicans can count on a third to maybe 30% in a good year. Of the Democratic side, which is two-thirds, 70%, there are probably about half who are still supporters of Israel and about half who either are not because they don't care. I mean, it's not a big article of faith for them, or because they're hostile. And among those who don't care, there's a sort of an inclination to simply be part of the crowd. If you're around people who think like you on all the other major issues, climate change, abortion, gay rights, income inequality, Trump is Hitler, then you don't want to disagree with them about Israel. So if Israel doesn't matter that much to you, you just shut up and you don't challenge them. So there are quite a few who fall into that category. They go along to get along. But historically, it was the Democratic Party that was the strongest support for Israel, and the Republicans were somewhat more isolationists, were sort of skeptical. And that all changed in really the last 25, 30 years, and Newt Gingrich had a lot to do with it. He made the Republican Party a bulwark of support for Israel. I mean, you look at the numbers now, and 80% of Republicans say they support Israel, and 30-35% of Democrats say they do, with about an equal number saying they support the Palestinians, and the rest don't have a decision, don't have a choice. So it's a growing number, and the problem is the people who tell you they want to get this debated, it's not saying, are they dreaming? Is it not debated on college campuses? Is it not debated
right.
in every magazine and every newspaper that's run by the establishment media? I mean, those organs have been unsympathetic to Israel for the last 20, 30 years.
Yeah. Let me, Richard, let me take a quick break, and then when I come back, I wanted to ask you a couple of follow-up questions to all of this, because it's fascinating. I was not familiar with the whole story. We'll be back with our friend Richard Baer right after we hear from one of our sponsors. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas. Just a quick promotion here for my good friend Carlos Geddes. We play his music on the podcast, and of course, Carlos is from Venezuela. He plays around the Dallas area, so I know that he and his wife Luisa are very concerned about what's happening in Venezuela. I have chatted with several friends from Venezuela, and they tell me that they've gone days without being able to talk to their families down there, and so it's a serious, very serious situation. Let's get back to our friend Richard Baer. Richard, with respect to the Jewish Americans and Israel, the ones who don't agree with the policy of support, what is it that they want? I mean, because the only reason the state of Israel has been able to survive, I'm not going to say the only reason, a big reason that it's been able to survive is because of the relationship, military assistance and support at the UN from the United States. What is it that, if they don't like our policy toward Israel, what is it that they promote, Richard?
Yeah, I mean, what I'll call the left in the Democratic Party does not believe that a state of Israel, a Jewish majority state, should exist. So every other nationality in the world can have their state, or a state where they're the majority, but the Jews cannot. The one state in the world that's Jewish majority, they reject. And they believe it should be a binational state, and eventually with a right of return for everybody, that the Arabs, the Palestinians, would soon outnumber the Jews. The Jews would wise up and some of them would leave the country, not wanting to be part of a 23rd Arab dictatorship. And in time, the Jewish population would decline. They'd have to move on again to somewhere else, and you just have an Arab-majority state of Palestine. That's what a significant number of the Jewish community who are on the left actually believe is the goal. They should think the United States should be even-handed, should not support Israel over the Palestinians, despite the fact that it's the only democracy in that region, that it respects women's rights and gay rights, it respects all freedom of speech, all of the Bill of Rights that we have are respected there as well, that they have a military draft, they defend themselves. I mean, that's one point I slightly disagree with. America certainly helped Israel, but Israel fights its own wars. It's never relied
on
soldiers.
Yeah, no, and I want to make sure I clarify that. I may have sounded I want to make sure I clarify that. You're exactly right. You're exactly right.
Believe me, American support is appreciated there, and Donald Trump is viewed much more favorably than Barack Obama was. Maybe one of the few countries in the world where that's the case. But maybe there are more. I think Venezuela may be another one.
And that's right. That's coming fast, yeah.
That's coming fast.
If nothing else, it's turning a lot of Venezuelans in Florida into Republicans.
Right.
That should be a factor in 2020.
Right. But I mean...
In a close election, that is.
I agree. But I mean, one of the reasons that Americans are pro-Israel is because Americans believe Israel is like America. I mean, it's a similar kind of country. They share values. There's respect for religious freedom. There's respect for minorities.
If Israel
solved the problem with the Palestinians, it's in part because the Palestinians haven't wanted to solve the problem.
That's right.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
They've had plenty of chances. I mean, it's not like Israel has been unwilling to negotiate. It's really shocking to me to hear that there is a person, a Jewish American in the United States, who thinks that if we change our policy, do they want everybody in Israel to be slaughtered? Or I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, no,
it's
I mean,
really
I
hard to follow.
Yeah, I mean, there's this delusional view that there can be one big happy family, a binational state, like that worked well in Yugoslavia, you know, and I can come up with a half dozen other examples where that has not worked very successfully. But somehow this, after all these years of fighting and one side really wanting to destroy the other side, and committing some of the most incendiary, horrific, violent acts that have ever been committed anywhere in the world in terms of attacks on civilians.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow this is all going to be, you know, Pete Seeger, we're going to play the music,
right,
and peace in our time, and everybody will live happily ever after, and the Palestinians want nothing more than a democratic state, which they can share with the Jews, and they're so welcoming and tolerant and open. I mean, it's like you throw up your hands and you say, this is what people want. I mean, are they that unrealistic, or is there an undercurrent, really, of just hostility to the Jews having a state? You know, there are some Jews who just are uncomfortable with the idea of Jews having any power, of Jews having a state of their own, of Jews being a, you know, having a respected military force in the world. They like it better when they're victims, because
yeah,
that's the mindset on the left now, is you want to be a victim. And, you know, the idea of Jews having to defend a Jewish state where they have power, that's just inconsistent with the hierarchy of intersectionality and shared victimhood. And, you know, you don't want to be a white colonialist,
no,
you know, which is...
No,
you know,
no, that's right. You don't want to be that. But I'm just fascinated because I never thought that... I mean, I always thought that you could count on one thing... with the Jewish Americans, because I always thought the Jewish Americans were like Cuban Americans in the sense that they were very tough on the embargo and that
sure,
kind of thing. And,
sure,
and I always thought it was the same thing. In fact, at one time when the Cuban American Foundation was created in Washington, D.C. as a political action committee, they were saying that the Cuban Americans were imitating Jewish Americans in how they were trying to influence U.S. Foreign policy.
There are still many Jewish Americans who are very committed to the survival
mm-hmm.
and growth of the state of Israel. And, you know, I don't want to make it sound like all the Democrats have this
sure.
sort of cockamamie view of the world, but it's a growing number. And it's in part because you have these people in America who spend all their time on social networking, have no knowledge of history, no appreciation for democracy or capitalism
mm-hmm.
or why sometimes wars have to be fought. I mean, I guess World
mm-hmm.
War II was necessary. Maybe they don't think so. You know, it's so long ago. It was before Facebook. I mean, it couldn't have been a very important thing to have happened.
Yes.
So.
No, you're right. I mean, it is frightening. You're right about young people and social media. We could do a whole show on that. Let me just ask you one more question about the resolution that was passed,
sure.
I guess, a few
sure.
days ago. What was your reaction to that resolution,
yeah.
if you want to call it a resolution? It sounded
yeah.
more like, you know, we hate everything, including our English teacher from first grade.
Right.
I mean, it just seemed like...
it was cowardice, basically, is what happened. Is
yes.
Is the most radical parts of the Democratic Party basically said no. They were not going to have... They were not would not approve a resolution that condemned Ilhan Omar by name and that just stuck to anti-Semitism. And the two groups that made up the force that really stopped Pelosi and Steny Hoyer from pushing this forward were the Congressional Black Caucus, and Ilhan Omar is from Somalia. She's a member of that caucus. She's African-American, or that's how she's viewed. And the Progressive Caucus, if you take those two groups, and there's some overlap, obviously, between the two, it's half the members of the Democrats in the House, of the 235 members in the House. So they have numbers. I mean, the last thing
mm-hmm.
that Pelosi wanted was a floor fight. You know, that would be the Democrats voting 114 to 121 to turn down the resolution, which would have been humiliating. So they create
right.
mush, and the mush is that we stand against everything that's hateful, whether it's, of course, white supremacy, which got to lead the league, Islamophobia,
homophobia. That's right.
And
Beatlephobia, Rolling Stones phobia. We're
yeah,
against everything that everybody hates. So everybody got to put down whatever they hate.
Yeah,
whatever they hate, they put it down.
Yeah, I mean, Stephen King, the Republican from Iowa, got himself into hot water by making some comments that he probably shouldn't have said. The Republicans removed him from three committees that he was on.
Mm-hmm.
Omar,
right.
Nancy Pelosi put this woman onto the Foreign Affairs Committee. This is a woman who said that Israel has hypnotized America, and only Allah can free America from this curse. This is what she said a few years ago. I mean, it's not like Pelosi's unfamiliar with her. She took a picture of her for Rolling Stone magazine with, you know, Alexandria Cortez and and Omar and a black congresswoman from Massachusetts, showing that she's excited by this new energy in the party. Well, this new energy just bit her leg off. And it's embarrassing. And believe me, the Democrats took power, and they have had a miserable 2 months between what went on with Virginia, with Jussie Smollett case in Chicago, you know, the fake victimhood of the attack by the MAGA hat man, MAGA hat men. It was about 10 below zero in Chicago that night. The idea that people would be on the street waiting for him to go to Subway. You know?
That's right.
And then they show him walking in his building. He still has the sandwich. They never took the sandwich from him.
Right. Well, the amazing thing is that the local media, I think, is the one who picked up on the temperature bit.
Right.
I mean, the local media, somebody probably at the local station got a report saying, there's a guy, a couple of guys out there, and it's 20 below. And they said, really? We don't believe that.
Yeah. It's the coldest days in Chicago since the day that they I remember that San Diego played Cincinnati for the AFC title game.
Yes.
It was about 80 below zero wind chill here.
Right.
That's the last
I remember that game. I remember that Dan Fouts couldn't pass the ball that day.
Right.
It was so cold. I remember that, watching that on TV. It was like Dan Fouts didn't know what to do. He had gotten to the AFC title game throwing 50 passes a game.
Right.
And now he couldn't do anything on that windy day.
They wanted to go into the locker room.
That's it. That's exactly right. Well, Richard, as always, thank you so much for your time. And I hope we can call on you again for a follow-up on this topic. It is fascinating. And one thing you said there at the end, I just wanted to follow up on, and that is that I think Democrats have had a very bad start. And I don't think it's going to get any better. In other words, if Nancy Pelosi thinks they're going to be happy just eating half of her leg, I mean, she still has another leg.
It's not like the impeachment sentiment and the Trump derangement syndrome are going to disappear because she says it's politically inopportune to go after Trump on impeachment. I mean,
explain that to them.
explain that to them.
The only people who are saying she's right are you and me. But everybody else on her side is saying she's weak and she doesn't want to do anything. She's afraid. Richard, thank you so much. And I enjoy your writing so much, and I enjoy everything you do so much. And I especially love the trivia question, which I sometimes get.
You do well. All right, Silvio.
Okay. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Richard Baer, chief political correspondent at The American Thinker. Obviously one of my favorite websites. I'm very fortunate that they put some of my stuff there once in a while, and I just love the website, and I'm sure many of you follow it as well from what I hear from many of my friends who read American Thinker. But Richard made some very good points today about the Democrats, and just one last point about Nancy Pelosi, or Speaker Pelosi, I should say, to be respectful. Speaker Pelosi may have underestimated the insanity in her party regarding impeachment. What she said made a lot of sense. You know, it's going to divide the country. But what she may not realize is that I think there's a bunch of Democrats, a lot more than she realizes, who are uncompromising on this issue. They want to get Trump. They want to get Trump, and they're willing to blow themselves up in order to get President Trump. And I think that's what we're going to see over the next couple of weeks when they go for impeachment anyway, with or without Speaker Pelosi. Again, our thanks to Richard Baer, and our thanks to all of you for tuning in. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.